Today's program is brought to you by Patina Events at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, an idyllic location for weddings, corporate events, and parties of any style. Visit us at patinaevents.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we get ready for Super Tuesday by looking at how food shapes elections both at home and abroad.
People know that you don't order a Philly cheesesteak with Swiss cheese as John Kerry did back in the 2004 cycle.
A young group of friends decided that they would put up a website which told voters which polling booths had sausages.
Prime Minister David Cameron was pictured about a week after this incident eating a hot dog in a bun with a knife and fork because he was so afraid.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection between food and grief, with your hosts, Zara Tangora
and Bobby Conforto.
Today on the show, we have a wonderful guest, Jess Quinn. Jess is a pastry chef and had a really significant experience with loss through the loss of her mother, which she's going to share with us on the episode.
And the caregiving of her mom, which is a whole nother aspect of grief.
Right. That is a very good point, Bobby. It is a whole nother aspect of grief. And it's so interesting to think about just the different ways in which we can lose people, you know? And I feel like a lot of times there's a conversation of, oh, I would rather this happen. Right. Either, you know, I'd rather die this way, or I'd rather lose someone this way, or
we don't usually get to choose.
You don't get to choose. And also there's so much that goes along with each thing, you know?
Yes.
And in this case, it was a slow process and it's very traumatic. And Jess is just a beautiful, wonderful person. We were so lucky to have her on. And Jess, thank you so much for sharing with us and being so open and vulnerable. And we hope you enjoy our conversation with her.
Thanks, Jess.
We're here with Jess Quinn. Jess brought us, I just want to mention before we get into anything else, just brought us some delicious Italian cookies, and we could not be more appreciative. They're delicious. I just had a rainbow, and it was really the best rainbow cookie I'd ever had. Can you remind us where they're from?
Yeah, they're from a bakery called Stella di Sicilia. It's a small family-run bakery and best Italian cookies in town.
Oh, my God. So good. And you mentioned when you came in that you don't like to show up empty-handed, which I really connect with. Is that from, like, a family?
I think it's definitely a Russian thing.
Okay.
I don't know. I feel like no matter where we were going, even if it was a family member and it was super casual, we were kind of always taught, like, you don't show up empty-handed. And so it just stuck with me.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I went to a dinner party the other night, and I brought something that I was, you know, for it was a potluck. And then I also brought some pussy willows. And I love pussy willows, but then I realized it's kind of a funny thing to bring and be like, here, I bought you pussy willows. Because you're saying pussy to your host, and there's no way around that being slightly awkward.
It's the thought that counts.
It truly is, and they make a lovely addition to any home. But really, that was really nice of you. So you're Russian.
Yes.
Okay, and grew up in Long Island?
Yes. Well, technically Latvian Ukrainian.
Wow.
But my parents grew up in Soviet era, so it was Russian.
Wow. Mom, you can you're half Russian, correct?
Yes. My mother grew up in Yugoslavia. On the border of Hungary and Yugoslavia, but my father, his parents were from, it's now Poland, but I don't know the geography very well.
Somewhere over there.
Right.
But you grew up on Long Island, so we share that because both Bobby and I grew up on Long Island. Not at the same time. She's significantly older than me. But no, so where'd you grow up in Long Island?
So I grew up in Cedarhurst, which is in the Five Towns.
Oh yeah, okay. Nice.
Yeah.
How do you feel like being an islander affected you in terms of your food mentality? Because I personally have a lot of things that I connect with. Like, what are some of your, like, specifically Long Island food memories?
I think strongest for us are probably pizza and bagels.
Yeah.
And then Italian cookies.
Yeah,
I feel like those would probably be the most influential foods I think about for Long Island.
Yeah. I also always feel like the two other things with Long Island, actually three, a good Greek diner.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
A good Greek diner, a good, like, regular diner. That's just, like, diner. But I guess you find those kind of everywhere. But, like, you know, the chromed out, old kind of looking diners. And a deli, like a good deli.
It's funny. We didn't do the delis.
Oh, really?
We weren't huge deli people.
Oh.
Well, I shouldn't say that. We did Russian delis, but we would drive to Brooklyn to go to them.
Yum.
Tell us about a Russian deli.
Yeah.
Well, so I don't know if you both are familiar with Brighton Beach.
Yeah.
But so we used to go there like every week. Mm. And like I think as a kid, everything feels further than it is. Mm-hmm. I remember feeling like it was like an actual journey that we were taking, which really I think it was just 30 minutes off the Bell Parkway.
Yeah, that's cute though.
But so my wife and I, we still try and go as often as we can, maybe every other week.
Awesome. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
What's your go-to? Like, what do you get?
So they have these little pitashki stands. Uh-huh. And so they're basically hot pastries filled with either sweet or savory fillings.
Yeah.
And so I introduced my wife, whose background is Irish, to something called a skopustum.
Uh-huh.
And it's basically sauteed sauerkraut and cabbage inside like a hot fried pastry.
Oh my God. Let's
okay,
go
let's
now.
Go.
Okay. Well, we know what we're doing after the
Actually,
show.
We've wanted to go there together and we never know where to go. So yeah. We'll have to.
Oh, I have a whole list.
Okay. Great.
It's amazing. Like one of my favorite places and I love telling people where to go.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. So what was the family structure like growing up?
I always think I have a straightforward family and then I start talking about it and I'm like, it's not as straightforward as I think it is. But so it was in my house, it was my mom, it was my dad, and then it was my sister and I. My sister is a year older than me. And we had a Polish nanny. And so both my parents were working parents. And so when I was 2 years old, we had a nanny that came from Poland and she never left. So she stayed until I left for college.
What was her name?
Irena. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that was the intention because she came with the intention of only being around for a year. She ended up staying for 16.
Yeah. Oh, man.
That must have been a lot of love.
Oh, my God. I think every time I misbehaved and she threatened to go back to Poland, I would just throw the biggest fit. That's like how she would get us to behave. But, you know, she was very important and she became more of a grandmother than a nanny. And
did she cook?
She did. No one in my family cooked that great, but she cooked. Uh-huh. She had a couple of staple items. My mom definitely did not cook at all. We were a takeout family.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
It's an interesting relationship. When you mentioned, and, you know, before we chatted today, we've chatted a little bit, and I got to know a little bit about you and some of your upbringing, and I was kind of honing in on the fact that you had this really close relationship with your nanny growing up, because it's not, you know, it's a unique relationship, right? Because you can form this, like, really strong kind of familial bond with someone who isn't your family. And in a way, I would think it allows you to get even closer because there's so much tension sometimes in families, even good family relationships. There's, you know what I mean? Like my mom and not you and I, but, you know, one's mom and I or dad. And there's all these kind of like little strenuous things, little cracks in the framework
and
throughout life.
And dynamics and whatever's going on.
Exactly.
In the
but there's like this opportunity, I would think, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I want to know what you feel about this, about having a relationship with someone who is essentially a family member but not.
Well, so when I was younger, I don't think I understood that. Like, I called her grandma.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, like, I'll always remember this day, but, like, I have another sister who we have a fraught relationship, but I remember there's a day where she was like, she doesn't love you. She's paid to be here.
Mm.
And I was like, I don't understand that. Mm. And I think it's hard for a kid to wrap their mind around the fact that someone's paid to care for them.
Yeah.
But you don't have to because it's in the heart. You knew what you felt in your heart.
Exactly. And it was funny because it's like, even though what she said was hurtful, I remember not believing it. Like in my head, even as a kid, I was like, those words don't resonate with me. And I remember going to Irena and just sobbing. And I was like, you're paid to be here.
Oh.
And I remember she broke it down. And what I loved about her is she kind of was no bullshit.
Yeah.
She was very honest. And we had so many just very honest conversations that I don't necessarily think a lot of adults have with children, which I feel like have stayed with me after all these years. But I remember she explained to me that, yes, she was paid, but that the love was not a part of the contract.
Yeah.
And I kind of remember her telling me that. And
They had such good chemistry together. You know, there's a concept for that in psychology, which is called the good mother.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that your own mother isn't good. It just means there's some people that represent that. They represent the good mother. It can be a teacher or a nanny or...
I like that.
Yeah. I do too, yeah.
And sometimes actually psychologically, when somebody doesn't have a good connection with their own mother, you could use that good mother. It provides nourishment yeah. even in thinking of them. And I'm sure when you think of her,
that kind
it
of explains
you.
It really nicely. I love that.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. Mm. So, about 5 years ago, correct? Around 5 years ago, you mm-hmm. found out that she had passed away?
Yeah. So when I left for college, at that point I was 18, and she'd already stuck around for so long. And she had a family of her own back in Poland, which I remember. I feel like I tried to intentionally not think about too much because I was just kind of like, okay, she left her family. And then I was like, will she leave me? And it was like yeah. this weird connection. And then also I was like, if she left me, I'd miss her. And I was like, they'll miss her. But so I went to college and I went to Buffalo, so I wasn't around anymore. And so she was like, okay, it's time to go back to Poland. Mm. And so she did. And it was nice because I spent a couple of summers with her after that going to visit her there.
Oh, wow.
And I got to finally meet like this elusive family that I'd, you know, only kind of seen photos of and heard about. And I was so scared they wouldn't like me because I felt like I had taken her away from them. And they were so warm and welcoming, and it was, I don't know, it was beautiful.
That's so nice. That's amazing.
Was it a part of the world where your own family was from, or was she from a different part?
No, so she was from Poland. She was from a town called Białystok, which is about 2.5 hours outside of Warsaw. Mm. And my family's Latvian-Ukrainian, right. which it's not too far, but kind of different mentalities. Mm. It felt like different dispositions, where my family, I feel like, was just very kind of direct and not cold, but not necessarily warm and fuzzy. Her family was the opposite, and it was so almost like unnerving because they were so like physically affectionate. Mm. Oh, wow. And I just kind of remember watching it one day, having like family dinner, and my nanny's daughter-in-law had like 2 grown adult sons, and they were like sitting on her lap.
Oh.
And it sounds crazy, but I was just watching it, and I was like, holy shit. I was like, this is perfectly normal.
Yeah.
And like, you're just nice.
Yeah. It's amazing to get to see inside other people's families and know what makes certain people the way they are. And it's always curious to me, the nature versus nurture kind of thing, you know? And even if you're explaining like your family wasn't physically affectionate and warm like that, but seeing hers, there's obviously a piece of you that's like compelled by it. And then like, where do you fit in? Where do you then make your own traditions for your own family? And it's kind of such like an interesting thing.
Absolutely.
Cultural differences.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
So also around, and then so she, a couple of years pass by from this time when you go off to college, right? Like
right.
6 years, 7 years.
Yeah, at that point, because I was 25. And it was in a convoluted way. Like, they couldn't get a hold of me. We'd moved around. And my wife and I had started, like, a food blog.
Oh, wow.
And so my nanny's granddaughter had, like, found me through the food blog and had sent an email to the food blog. Mm. And she was just like, I need you to call me. And I immediately lost my shit because I was like, it can't be anything else. I just felt it.
Yeah,
those moments.
And, you know, my wife, then girlfriend, she was just like, well, maybe it's something else. And I was like, it's not. Like, I just know it's not. Yeah. And I just remember I tried calling, no one answered. And then I got the email and she was just saying that it was too painful to talk about over the phone. And so she had died 9 days prior. Mm. So...
How did she die?
Sleeping, which when I think about it, was definitely maybe the most gentle way I could picture
Absolutely.
It. But she was 79 and she passed away sleeping.
Mm, I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
So around the same time, you got some other news that was very difficult. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So it was really... It was kind of challenging because, you know, you're 25 and it's just like this weird age already because you're trying to be an adult.
Yeah.
You're not necessarily fully there yet.
Right. It's a weird, it is a weird
It's
time.
Like a weird age.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's like, I think there's so many expectations of yourself and from society and it's really kind of daunting to try and meet them all. But around this time, my mother, who had been a bookkeeper for like 30 plus years at this company, she had been let go. And so... At first, I kind of thought it was a really good idea, and I was excited for her because she'd worked so hard her whole life. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. You know, she at this point sold the house we grew up in Long Island.
And your parents are divorced?
They're divorced. And she like really hung on to that house for a long time because she kept thinking of it as something she would leave for my sister and I. And it wasn't really something either of us wanted. We wanted her to have just kind of like an easy life where she didn't have to maintain this house. And she ended up getting an apartment in Forest Hills at okay. this point.
How old was she at that then?
62 or 63. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't think she was that old, which I don't think is old.
It is old. No.
Right? I'm like, I don't think it is old. But so no. she was let go from her job. And so at first, my sister and I, we like threw her a party and we were like, okay, well, now you can really enjoy your life. Mm. And I was working as a barista at this point. I'd worked in the food industry for a long time. And I was like, okay, I need a little break from kitchens.
Yeah.
They get exhausting.
I feel like we both can understand that. Yeah.
So I was like, okay, maybe a little like face-to-face interaction, make some coffee, like I'll take it easy. And so at that point, it was probably a few months into her retirement where I just started noticing small things. And they were really small at first. Like she wasn't really picking up the phone as often as she used to. Mm. Like she was a little harder to get a hold of. She would misplace things, but you know, we all get forgetful. And then it just, the small things started kind of piling up and piling up. And my sister was living in either Austin or Chicago at this point. So she wasn't local. Mm. And I just remember calling her and I was like, something feels wrong. And like, couldn't really figure it out. And like, I kind of tried talking to my mom about it. And she was just like, I'm perfectly fine. Nothing's wrong. But she also started becoming antisocial at this point, which was really kind of odd for her because she'd always been a social butterfly. She loved dressing up and going out, and she started just like sitting in her living room and just watching TV and just shutting everyone out, and it was just very uncharacteristic for her. And so I made an appointment to go see a doctor, and so I took her with me, and they didn't really take it seriously. They kind of dismissed it, and they were like, well, it's just old age, and that's what happens. And I was
maybe
like,
maybe thought it was depression or something.
Right.
Yeah, which, you know,
it's staggering also, sorry to interrupt, but how I was just reading something recently about how women are not often taken seriously
absolutely
at
correct.
The doctor. They're sent home for chest pain. They're dismissed, especially by male doctors, but by other female doctors.
Or if there's a male there, they'll talk to the male about the results of something instead of the female.
I wish I didn't say it, but yeah, the last few years were very eye-opening for me and the healthcare system and just how it treats one, women, and two, the elderly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really not the best.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think it took a year of me taking her to doctors to finally have someone that even offered to give her a memory test.
That's absurd.
It was. It was crazy. And also, like, I think my age played into it. Like, I was still at this point only 25.
Right.
And they kind of were like, well, what do you know?
So they dismissed both of you.
Exactly.
I'm so sorry about that. And I'm sure as the story progresses, you're going to let us know about a lot more ways in which this is a painful experience. But, man, what a insult to injury.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Because already you just, you know, I'm not the most intuitive person, but I feel like when I have a strong feeling, I try and listen to it.
Yeah.
And it's like, I knew something was wrong.
Yeah.
And it's like, listen, you know this person your whole life. Like, something doesn't feel right. I kind of feel like, trust that feeling.
Yeah.
So.
So you kept kind of forging on with.
Yeah. I found a really great GP for myself who I ended up then taking my mom to. And she was the first person that, well, one, she was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I think just by chance, because of the specialties I was looking into were mostly male dominated.
Mm.
This was the first female doctor I'd taken her to. And immediately she was just like, okay, well, let's like do all the tests and let's give her a memory test. And she failed it miserably. Yeah. There was one portion of it where she just needed to replicate a hexagon. She needed to draw the hexagon. And I guess that was, like, the major tell. She, like, drew a line and a squiggle.
Yeah.
And she was like, there's obviously a mental deficit happening. And
part of the brain was...
Right. Like, she was like, something's not connecting. And she was the first person that finally, like, validated what I'd been feeling.
And what was the conclusion that she drew? What was the diagnosis?
So at that point, she was just like, your mom definitely has dementia, which is such a broad umbrella. Yeah.
And early onset in her 60s.
Exactly. Which, unfortunately, another part of early onset is that the degradation happens much more rapidly. Mm. And so from that point on, I think it was only a year from the diagnosis to my mom having to go into a nursing home.
Oh, my goodness.
Man.
So,
because she couldn't take care of herself. And
no, and I've talked about this for hours with my wife for, like, years now, but it's, like, the guilt I felt over that was awful.
Yeah.
Because trying to take a parent out of, like, their home and telling them that they need to go is, like, one of the most awful things I think anyone can do.
I've been there,
yeah,
and I really understand that.
Like, it's hard to explain, and especially I was, like, I think 27 at that point, I had gone through like home nurse care because I did my best to try and keep her in the home because I didn't want to take her out of the home.
How did you pay for that? Because that's part of the problem with home nursing. It's
so expensive.
And but there isn't proper insurance for that.
No, there isn't. And we got so lucky because my mom did end up selling that house in Long Island. We were able to use that money to care for her.
Right. It is really hard. I had the same experience with my dad. My dad had had cancer for 10 years, and he was also just in terrible physical shape and could barely do anything for himself. And he had established all these kind of like hacks and tricks, like backing out of the garage to get the mailbox, but like then he'd smash the side mirror off and, you know, reaching things with his cane. But eventually, after too many times, he'd like pull off the cabinet and stuff like that. And it was very clear to me that he also needed to leave the house. And he was also running out of money. So, but had all these things in his house, like a pinball machine. And we used to fight. And I'd be like, get rid of this fucking pinball machine. You know what I mean? Really? Like, does it? He's like, I like to have it when people come over. And but the sense of like pride and stuff, it's so hard telling anyone, especially your parent, who like the dynamic in that where then you become the adult so quickly and you're telling them what to do with their life and their
like
stuff.
It feels like overnight.
It's terrible. Yeah. It's so humiliating for everyone.
And they're holding on with every ounce of strength to hold on to because they have so many losses.
Totally.
They've lost so many things along
it's
the way.
It's so hard for everyone.
Yeah.
With my dad, he ended up getting sick like 2 years ago and had to go to the hospital. And once that happened, we knew like he had to get rid of his dogs. He like was going to have to go into a nursing home. And he just, when that became a reality, he just died. He actually 2 years ago tomorrow, he just died. He was like, no, you know, I don't know.
I've heard a lot of stories like that too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where, like, the will is just gone.
Yeah, it's really, but
well,
I can.
You fight, and then give up.
Sometimes you just let go, but I really, like.
Instead of change.
Yeah.
Change is hard.
Change is very hard.
Let's agree on that.
But, man, like, that feeling of that responsibility and pressure, I mean, I really know what that feels like. I think Bobby does, too. It's just, like, those times in life where you're like, I really don't want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is not fair.
It's funny because I feel like that was an expression I use so much.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, obviously everyone knows life isn't fair.
Yeah.
But when you feel like you've been so slighted.
Yeah.
Because at this point, I had also gotten engaged and I was planning my wedding. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, this is fucking awful.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm shopping for a wedding dress and putting my mom in a nursing home. Yeah. I was like, this is not how I pictured it.
Yeah.
And to like come to terms with the fact that this is your reality is probably something that took me the longest.
Mm-hmm.
Just because as much as maybe my mom was in denial, I also was like, well, maybe it's not so bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's pretty bad.
Yeah.
And just a statement about our country and healthcare again, right here, there is not anything that people can really afford that is a viable option that is loving and caring and nurturing. Yeah. It's
terrible.
So what was the nursing home like that you had to put her in?
So we got lucky to an extent. I found, so the first step was assisted living because she was still able to kind of function on her own, but she needed supervision because she would forget to eat. And at this point, she'd lost a lot of weight, but she was still walking on her own and like communicating. And I found a place that was like 5 minutes walking from my apartment.
Oh, good.
Mm.
So it was super close.
Yeah.
And we got her like her own bedroom with like a king size bed. And so like we decorated it and made it really cute. I felt a little shitty because we like lied to get her into it. Like we like told her that like, I don't know what we said, but we said that her apartment building was being evacuated and all the residents needed to find new homes. And that, like, we found her this, like, really cute new apartment that was closer to us so we would see her more. And so we, like, showed her this, like, room, and, like, at first she was super excited. And it was funny because she was doing, like, a happy dance. And so the director of the facility was like, it's easier if you kind of leave now and let her get adjusted. And so we did.
Yeah. It's okay. We're all crying. No, it's, yeah. It's intense. It's
I have a funny story to tell now, just for a little levity. So I did the same thing with my mom. We had a mover from Florida, mover up here, and, you know, she didn't have Alzheimer's. Your mom had Alzheimer's? My mom had dementia, but it wasn't severe. So we got her into the assisted living the first night. My mom always loved the cocktail hour. She wasn't an alcoholic, but she loved the cocktail hour. It was, she was famous for it. Famous for
soda.
So I brought her the first night to the assisted living, and she sat down with the group, and she wasn't a social person. She didn't really love groups of people, but she sat down the first night, and they had carafes of wine on the table. She thought it was her glass. She took the entire carafe, brought it to herself, and said, "This place is wonderful."
Just got hammered.
I love that.
Yeah, that's great. So what were you?
But so we left her. We left her there to go home because I knew that if I needed to come back, I could be there in a couple of minutes. Yeah. But it was really funny because so she called me maybe an hour after we left. She calls me, and this was her personality. This is why I was laughing. She called me. She's like, "Something's a little off about this place." And I was like, "What do you mean?" And she goes, "There's so many old people." She's like, "Why?" And it's just like, and it just made me laugh because I was like, oh, she has no idea.
Yeah.
Because she was just kind of like the always like, fun, lighthearted, really well-dressed, like, person.
Yeah.
And so she sees all these, like, old people walking around with walkers and canes, and she was just like, "Why'd you bring me here?"
Yeah, this is a weird choice.
And I was just like, I was like, "It's fine." I was like, "Just get to know them." And she's like, "They're playing bingo." And I was like, "You don't need to play bingo." And I was like, "I'm not." And I was like, "Okay, you don't have to."
But I guess I'm wondering if you felt this way. When I did actually walk out of the building, I felt somewhat secure because I knew that there was a staff of people and that there was a support system there. I mean, that felt good.
Yeah, I mean, so with the home aid, we could only afford to have her there for like maybe 8 hours a day, which still sounds like a lot. Mm. But then I was like, okay, she's alone the rest of the time when I'm at work. And that was terrifying. Right. So the security was there, but I think the guilt might have overshadowed it.
Yeah. So what do you mean by guilt? What does that mean to you?
I feel, well, even though this the facility was nice, they're just not where you picture your parent being, and it's not where you want them to be.
So that's disappointment, but how does it feel like guilt? Because I understand I had guilt too, but I have investigated that to really see what it means.
The guilt probably felt like I couldn't take care of her. Like, I couldn't bring her home with me.
That was a fact.
Yeah. And we had a one-bedroom apartment, you know, and worked crazy hours, and, like, we didn't make a ton of money, and so, like, logistically, of course, I knew that we couldn't take care of her. But, you know, on an irrational level, it just felt wrong. Like, it felt wrong to leave her there, because I was like, well, she wouldn't leave me somewhere.
I guess what it is, I'd like to think that, you know, it was a disappointing situation, but you were not a disappointment. You sound like an amazing daughter.
Yeah.
So much love.
Thank you.
Yeah. Full and sweet.
Yeah.
At this point, where are you at in your cooking career? And also, like, are you cooking at home? Are you, because you mentioned to me when we spoke before the podcast that you would cook, like, a bake growing up to kind of check, you know, take your brain offline. Was this something that you were doing
There was a lot of dessert baking.
Yeah.
And it's crazy, but I have a lot of food memories, actually, with my mom from this period of time. Which wasn't necessarily home cooking, because she never really liked home cooking, but she liked to go out to eat. Mm. And another weird aspect of dementia is that people's taste buds change and, like, flavor preferences change, which I wasn't really expecting. But she kind of – my mom had been a health nut her whole life and like was always dieting.
Yeah.
She was just always like trying to lose weight and just kind of very cautious about what she ate. And I felt like all of those like restrictions and rules went out the window.
Wow.
And so going out to eat was just a lot more fun now.
Yeah.
And so I just have a lot of memories of these like indulgent meals with her.
Can you tell us about one in particular?
Yeah, it's probably my favorite actually of all of them. But so she did eventually end up having a great team of all female doctors at Mount Sinai.
Nice.
And I kind of made it that way because they were more compassionate and they were less dismissive.
Yeah.
And that combination worked for us.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, a couple of years into her diagnosis, she was told that she needed to have a hysterectomy. And so for me, I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Like, that's not... It's not great.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of cute. Like, she didn't really, like, my mom didn't really understand what that meant, but she could kind of read the atmosphere in the room, and she could read the vibe, and so I could see that she looked concerned, and I didn't want her to be. It's kind of like when you have a kid, and you're trying to, like, you know, shit's going down, but you don't want them to know that, so you're just trying to be lighthearted. So we left the hospital. We had made an appointment to go back to get the surgery. And we had the rest of the afternoon. And so I kind of was like, okay. I was like, what do you want to do with the rest of the day? And she just looked at me and she's like, I want to have a really nice lunch.
Mm.
And I was like, okay. And so this was like up in Midtown by like Columbus Circle area. And so it was like 11:30 in the morning and a place called Quality Meats was open.
Mm-hmm.
So we roll in at like 11:45. We're both kind of dressed in sweats, like not really very presentable. And it's just dudes in business suits, like definitely having corporate lunches.
Yeah.
And my mom and I sit down and I was like, what do you want? And she's like, I want a really nice glass of Merlot. And I was like, okay. So we ordered a bottle of Merlot and the server comes over and it was really funny. But I feel like at this point I just kind of gotten used to like patronizing men, but it was funny. We're at a steakhouse and he asked if we wanted to hear the fish special. And I was like, no, we don't want to hear about the fucking fish special.
Exactly.
And so we got the porterhouse for two with a side of fries.
That's awesome.
And we got the bottle of wine and then we finished with ice cream sundaes.
That is amazing. Wonderful.
And it just felt good.
Yeah.
And like, I feel like we sat there for hours and we ate this lunch and she was happy, and I was happy, and it just kind of felt like we were, like, in this little cocoon.
Yeah. Sarah and I talk about this a lot. We learned it from my mom, who was a Holocaust survivor, and somehow could celebrate life. She had lost a daughter, and despite all her losses, she had an ability to just celebrate in the moment, and that's what you guys did. It was such a beautiful moment. In the face of difficulties, you were celebrating together and sharing together.
And I feel like I learned that from her. Because both my parents grew up in, like, the Soviet Union, and they were both, they both also came from Holocaust-surviving families.
Mm.
And so I feel like there was a lot of despair and kind of a dark history, and no one ever talked about it. Like, it was kind of like this unspoken rule, but never really talked about these things. But somehow, like, life just felt like it was meant for celebrating.
Yeah.
And I loved it.
It's also just like the small, it feels like when you were talking about that, I was just kept thinking like small victories, you know, in the times of like the hardest hardship, like the little wins, you know, like the little special times you carve out that you weren't expecting to. And in fact, I feel like those times you can never necessarily expect to. It is the, like rolling up in your sweatpants to be like, well, what do you want to do? Like, well, let's do something special.
Yeah.
And those times turn out to be these profound, like, you know, pillars that you can look back and laugh on or look back and feel good about. And, you know, just the little wins.
Yeah. I think it's called resilience. I think that's part of what resilience is.
Yeah.
It's being able to like just dig in and find and flowers grow and blossom. And
It's the flowers growing out of the cracks.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a small break. And when we come back, we're going to have some more with Jess.
Patina Restaurant Group offers unparalleled service in New York's most iconic locations, including Lincoln Center and Macy's Herald Square. Patina is also the exclusive caterer at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. From meetings and presentations in the glass-walled atrium to galas in the renovated Palm House and intimate wedding showers at Yellow Magnolia Cafe, Your event will be perfectly imagined and customized at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. You can also enjoy brunch and lunch at the picturesque Yellow Magnolia Cafe overlooking Lily Pool Terrace. Executive Chef Sarah Flynn's unique menu includes modern dishes with global flavors, with a focus on local and seasonal ingredients.
And we're back with Jess Quinn. Jess, we were talking before we took a break about small victories, and we were talking about your mom's battle with dementia. So as this progresses, just like take us there, if you don't mind, just through kind of maybe the latter half of the, there was a 5 year from diagnosis to,
yeah,
to her death. What was it like kind of in the later stages for you?
The later stages are probably the hardest ones. I think it's hard to describe, but I think the thing with dementia is people don't want to talk about it. Yeah. And I really didn't want to share my story with people either. I felt very kind of protective of that aspect of my life because I didn't think my peers could understand.
Yeah.
And the few times I feel like I did try talking about it, the way they related almost made me furious.
It's, really? Like how?
Yeah. Well, I think a common thing is like, oh yeah, well, you know, my grandmother had dementia, or right, like my grandfather had dementia. And it feels, I don't know how to describe it, because the intention behind them trying to relate is obviously a good one. They want to be able to relate to you. But at the same time, here you are like in your late 20s,
right,
taking care of a parent. There's no roadmap. You have no idea, yeah, what you're doing. Yeah. You're not established. You're not like in your 50s, where I feel like, yeah, is a more, I don't want to say appropriate, but maybe a more, yeah, common age, well, that you're taking care of, it's a parent.
It's a traumatizing experience, absolutely, what you went through. You know, it really is. It's traumatizing. It's,
yeah, it's hard at any age, but you were absolutely right. You were at a time of growing your life, and you probably wanted to focus on your life.
Yeah.
And you really had to pay so much of your attention towards your mom and her needs.
And it wasn't even that as much as I wanted her to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. Like, I just felt like all of these moments came up and, like, she wasn't present in the way I wanted her to be. And so I think I felt a lot of rage. Mm-hmm. And, like, I think probably anger and frustration are the most probably strong feelings that I felt at the time, because I had just gotten married and then, you know, everyone like kept asking about my mom every time we went to like see someone about like a cake or a wedding dress. And it was really funny. But so I actually had a Hungarian seamstress, my last wedding dress fitting. I went by myself. I didn't want anyone to go with me. And it was just me and this like Hungarian seamstress. And I remember she just like kept patting my butt and kept telling me that I looked great.
Aww.
And I was like, I'm just going to pretend you're my mom. I was, aww, like, it's fine.
That's so tender and so sweet. And you know, what you're describing, like with chronic illness, pieces are lost all the time. There's pieces of her,
mm-hmm,
yeah,
that were lost.
It's interesting. I think that we live, you know, the way people kind of do talk about grief, the very limited ways in which people talk about grief and death in our society, I think, is that often there's a conversation of, well, if I was going to lose someone, I'd want to lose them this way. Or if I'm going to die, I would want to die this way. I'd want to, mm-hmm, die instantly. Or I'd want I'd want the person I love, you know, it's something that people talk about. And I think it's so interesting because the freak accident, the like instant loss of someone, is so traumatic and painful for one reason, because you never get a chance to say goodbye. But I can speak from personal experience, and I'm wondering if you agree, that the losing somebody over an extended period of time is, you do get to say goodbye. You do get to try to wrap your head around it, but you're so traumatized
for
such a
long
time. Countless
losses over and over again.
It is funny because a lot of people, once again, well-intentioned,
yeah,
you know, they were like, well, it must have been easier because you had time to prepare.
Right.
I don't know if I agree with that.
Yeah.
Because by the time my mom did pass, at that point, I'd kind of wanted her to die at that point.
That's the
for
confusing,
at least 2 years.
100%.
And I think
same
that's
my
the
dad,
part where you're just like, holy shit, I'm a terrible person.
Right. And you're like, I want my parent to die? What a monster.
And I would say it. Yeah. Like, I feel like I would just have to say it out loud, because I was like, it felt like a dirty thought,
yeah,
that I,
yeah,
would need to like put it out and just say it.
I talk about the word and a lot, the duality that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, you loved her. You wanted to have every bit of her. And it was so difficult to watch her decline.
Yeah.
For her, for you, for everybody. I have a little story to tell here that's very descriptive.
Yeah.
I ran many bereavement support groups, and I was running a bereavement support group for mothers, parents, and it was the first day, and in the first day, everybody describes their story. And the first person said, you know, my son died in a car accident, and it was sudden, and I didn't get to say goodbye. And, of course, it was the first day, so they're filled with emotion.
Yeah.
And the person next to her was glaring at her. And I didn't know why. I couldn't understand it. She said, my son was sick for 30 years. He had muscular dystrophy. He died 1,000 times. I watched every time he almost died. I felt it. And they started to fight with each other. The two of them, it was worse for me. It was worse for me. And the whole group, we got it in that moment. It just fucking sucks. That's it. There's no other way around it, no matter what way. There's no comparison, but each one has its own aspects.
Yeah.
And what you've been describing is the drip, drip, drip of loss for 5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like someone is chipping away at the person you know and the life that you had with them over this extended period of time, and you're just grasping for whatever you can. But I also feel like this period of time could be described as panic because every time I got a missed call or the phone went off or anything, I felt like I was constantly ready to run into action.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm in a war. I'm fighting this battle.
Hypervigilant.
And it's like, I also feel like I just turned off my feelings at this point because I was like, if I let myself feel what's actually happening, I was like, I'm not going to actually be able to be, you know, the person or the advocate that she needs me to be for her, because the last 2 years were definitely the worst. I mean, at that point, she went into a full-time nursing care. Mm-hmm. She couldn't feed herself. She couldn't eat solid food, you know. And, you know, I hated saying it, but sometimes I would show up and I would look at her and I would just be like, I hate you. Mm-hmm. Like,
absolutely.
It feels like...
Those are real feelings.
It feels like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Yeah. I was like, you sort of look like my mom at that point, even physically she didn't look like my mom.
Yeah.
And I was like who are you?
You
look at this person, you don't recognize them, and then you're like, I don't like the person I am with you, because you're like, this isn't a very nice person.
Totally. There's so much anger there. I felt the same thing when my dad was dying. I just remember especially at the very end when he was in the hospital for like a month or so, I remember being furious. And then looking back on that, I'm like, man, I wish I wasn't so furious. But then after going back again, I'm like, it's okay.
Yeah.
You are allowed to be furious. This is an enraging situation.
And you're alone.
Right. Like, similarly, I mean, you know, for the most part, pretty alone. And I think that it's reasonable. And I hope that people who are listening out there, like, know that they're not alone in feeling like a gamut of emotions.
Absolutely.
One of which is rage. And another one is wanting somebody to die.
Mm-hmm.
Who you love. What a complicated mindfuck that is.
It's so complicated.
Yeah.
So I'd like to address the anger. I've been thinking about that a lot this week with the clients that I've seen. A lot of people were bringing up anger for different reasons, whether it was sudden loss or what you're describing. The feeling is not the problem. It's what do we do with it?
Yeah.
So when you look back now and you experience that anger, what did you do with it?
I did a lot of running.
Okay. Mm. Actual running, physically
running?
Yeah,
I picked up running.
Yeah, like Forrest Gump, who ran for 3 years.
Exactly. It felt good, and it felt like I was kind of able to run my rage out.
It's externalizing the energy.
Yeah, and just sweating and maybe turning my mind off a little bit.
Yeah.
Imagine
if you were turning that in and not out.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a lot of unhealthy lashing out at people and kind of shutting myself out. You know, my wife was always like, I'll come and visit her with you. And I didn't want my mom to lose her dignity.
Mm.
And I had a hard time letting people come and go and see her with me. And so it was a very small group. It was just my best friend for my whole life who could come with me and my wife.
Yeah.
Because
you're carrying your mom's dignity.
Yeah, because I just knew. I knew that if she could see herself, I knew that she would be like, fuck no.
Yeah.
Like, people are feeding me, they're changing me, they're bathing me, and she would have been horrified. And so much of kind of who she was the image that she portrayed.
Yeah.
And I was just like, she would be just devastated.
Yeah. You know, as you talk, the truth is that she wasn't probably feeling it as much as you were, because parts of her brain had shut down. You were feeling it for her.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, because I knew, like, I knew how she would feel. Yeah. I just remember there's a day kind of towards the end, I think it was the last few months, because everyone kept preparing us, and that's another thing. Everyone's like, okay, well, it's definitely happening now. And then you're like, when?
Yeah, the
you're
waiting.
You're literally waiting for the when.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then you rationalize it, and you're like, okay, well, how many times I Googled when is it normal to die after diagnosis is so crazy.
Yeah.
Because, like, no one can actually tell you.
Exactly.
But you're like, okay, if I have, like, a date.
Yeah.
You're like, maybe it won't hurt as bad, I guess.
A little story about that. When my father was dying, I remember he was in Florida, and I was going onto a plane, and I had one foot on and one foot off, and I didn't know which way to go. I didn't know whether to stay or to go. It was just this strange moment.
It's a really tough time.
Yeah.
So when was it? When did it actually happen?
So in March, she ended up having a bad case of pneumonia. Mm-hmm. And, like, I got the phone call. And the thing is, I'd gotten the phone call so many times, so I was like, I mean, obviously I was concerned, but I was just like, okay, well, it's just another hiccup. Because, you know, delusions. Yeah. But I went and I saw her, and not great. Like, looked awful. But so, lucky enough, I took her and found a lawyer, like, at the very beginning of this process. She didn't have a will. She didn't have the health proxy or any of that. So we got all of that paperwork sorted. And we went down the list about DNR and, like, what do you want? What don't you want? She was like, I don't want anything. She was like, if I'm not, like, eating and breathing on my own, she was like, leave me alone. And so at this point, she was hooked up to all the monitors, and she had an IV with the antibiotics for the pneumonia, and then she had an IV for the fluids. And so I, like, came to this road where I called my sister, and I just remember crying, and I was like, okay, I was like, I think this is really it. And she was like, how do you know? And I was like, because I'm disconnecting her from the IVs. Sorry.
No, you don't need to be sorry.
It's just another time. How brave.
Yeah.
So we disconnected her from the IVs, and I remember the woman came over with the sheets to fill everything out, and I remember signing it, and I felt like I was killing her.
Yeah.
But you know in your logical mind that she had been dying all along.
And I knew. And I was like, at this point, I was like, there's nothing to salvage. She wouldn't want to live like this, but, like, this was probably the first time where it really felt concrete.
Yeah.
So we disconnected her from the IVs, and she passed away 48 hours later.
Yeah.
Did she have hospice care, or it was in the nursing home?
It was in the nursing home, because they it was nice because the nursing home offered the hospice care, so everything was kind of taken care of there.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know if you saw that, I had worked in hospice for 12 years.
No, so, I didn't know that.
So I really do understand the grace of making those kinds of decisions, how hard they are, but it's such grace, you know, that you carried and for her.
Yeah.
Were you working at this time?
Yeah. So at this point, we were living in the Finger Lakes, and so I'd come down to kind of get, well, I came down for a job interview. We wanted to move back down to Brooklyn at this point. And I got the phone call when I was on the job interview. And so it was also the craziest thing because here I am on this, like, really big, important job interview. And then I need to go disconnect my mom's IVs. And I was like, ugh. I was like, doesn't get easier.
Yeah, that's a face smush in the mud moment.
You're just kind of like, what the fuck's happening?
Yeah, that's
you're like,
terrible.
None of this is normal. I do remember, though, when I signed the paperwork to have the IVs disconnected, this one woman, and I'll never forget it, I think she meant a kindness, but I remember I was crying, like, so hard, and she, like, patted me on the back, and she goes, don't worry. She goes, she might survive a few more months, and I was like,
oh, God.
I was like, why would you say that?
Yeah. People say the weirdest things at all. I remember, I mean, this wasn't after a death, but I was in a really, really bad accident when I was 21. I was in a bus that went off a cliff.
Oh, God.
And my whole hand became, like, ripped apart and, like, mangled. And I remember going into the hospital, like, in the middle of the night, and this, like, attending doctor comes over, and he was like, we were in the middle of nowhere. And he comes over and goes, don't worry, you can get along just fine with just a couple fingers. And he only had, like, one finger. And I was like, this is not comforting.
You realize that life is just a series of nightmares that you have to laugh at.
I actually, there was this guy that I used to kind of follow. That makes me sound like I'm in a cult, but he was like a he gave Dharma talks, and he would talk about pop-ups in horror land is what he would call them. Mm-hmm. So it'd be like when you're on a like a haunted house ride, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden something like springs up. It's like, rah! It's like, and then the rest of the ride is kind of smooth and something's like, ah! And it's about your reaction and like, what do? Do you tense up and freeze up?
Yeah,
do you
like true.
Face it? Do you realize that it's like, you're going to get past, it's probably not going to kill you, you know?
Yeah.
That's very powerful. Yeah. What you just said. That's yeah. kind of what I talk about
it's,
all day.
It's interesting.
I also think of Andy Warhol and his painting with heaven and hell. Mm. You know, it's both.
Yeah.
This life is heaven and hell.
Yeah.
Both,
yeah.
Whatever that means.
So a lot of folks who come on talk about post when somebody dies, the things that, you know, folks will try to bring them food wise. Like, did people reach out to you with bringing food to you or trying to do stuff like that?
A lot of people reached out. I was not the quickest to respond.
Mm.
I was also in the middle of planning a funeral.
Yeah.
And once again, Google, just everything's Google. I was like, we don't really have anyone to like talk to. And my sister had to fly in from out of town, and
yeah.
my cousin came in from out of town. And we kind of all convened in this like hotel in like downtown Manhattan. And it was nice because everyone kind of left it up to me. They're like, what do you want to do? I already knew that I was going to cremate my mom, and I found a place that like I wanted them to do it. But I also knew that I didn't want a funeral. I was like, that woman spent her whole life celebrating and enjoying life. I was like, it seems very counterintuitive to have a funeral and have a somber event. And so we made a reservation at a Russian restaurant in Brighton.
Wow.
I told everyone to get dressed up and look the best that they could. We had countless bottles of wine and liquor.
Yeah.
And just giant Russian banquet style.
Ugh.
And everyone just kind of ate and drank leisurely all afternoon and went around the table just telling stories about her.
Yeah.
You are very intuitive. You said you weren't intuitive before. You are mastering intuition.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just feel like I knew her.
Yeah.
Which is a good feeling because I hear a lot of people feel like they don't really know their parents. Mm. And I feel like I really knew her. But it was funny because the thing that kept popping up was almost every story was about food. And it made me feel so good because I was like, she really was as generous as I think she was. And so all the stories were like, I remember Sunday morning bagels at your house. Or I remember that when your mom ordered Chinese food, it was like 20 egg rolls for three people. And it's like the biggest offense to her would have been that someone came to her home and they left hungry.
Oh, that is just lovely. Yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of crying, but it felt like good crying.
Oh, yeah, there is good crying in there.
Well, my business name is Bittersweet. I love that word.
I do,
love
too.
Bittersweet.
Yeah.
And this was sweet bitter.
Yeah.
This
was
so sweet.
I don't know. And then it was cute. We all we all took pictures at sunset on the boardwalk afterwards. I don't know.
And the ocean was there.
Yeah. I don't know. It felt like if we were going to say, not goodbye. I hate saying goodbye, but if we were going to celebrate her life, I don't think that we could have done it in a better way.
Yeah. 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 So you're coming up on the 1 year.
Almost. Yeah.
What date is that?
March 14th, because my best friend knew I needed some comic relief. And she said, well, great. She's like, your mom fucked up Pi Day for you.
What's that? Pi National
3.14.
Oh, 3.14. Yeah. Oh man. Do you feel affected by the looming like date approaching at all? I know when my dad died, the year one was very, for me, I was just like, okay, it's gonna be a year. Like, not that I thought I would be devastated or not devastated, I just kept thinking, but is the 1 year meaningful to you in either way?
It wasn't, I don't know, I feel like that wasn't as much as her birthday was a few months after she passed. Mm. And that was kind of hard for me because I was just at work and then suddenly it hit me.
Yeah.
And like, I've told my sister the most embarrassing thing is that you don't know when the grief is going to strike.
Yes.
And normally it's in public and it's embarrassing and messy.
Yeah.
But her birthday and actually my birthday. I had my birthday and it was beautiful and it was great and I had my friends and I just turned to Trina, my wife, and I was like, this is the first birthday I have ever had where she's like not on the planet.
Yeah.
And that's hard.
It's really hard.
But yeah. She is clearly in your heart.
Big time.
Woof.
When is your birthday?
It's in August.
Okay, just so we can send you a card.
It's in August, August 20th. I'm a Leo, okay. Which through and through.
Yeah.
But also, I think probably the hardest about post-death for me is that this has probably been for me the most kind of just big year of growth and career for me that I've ever had.
Tell us about that. What is your work?
So I'm the pastry chef of a restaurant in Manhattan called Rosadora. And so we opened, I think like a month after she passed.
Wow.
I got the job 2 weeks after she passed.
So you got the job.
I got the job. I got the job. I accepted the job. And we were back and living in New York maybe like 6 weeks after this entire thing.
You had so many changes all at once.
So many. And I just went right into it. But so sounds gross, but we had a New York Times review and we got 3 stars. And my mom always read the New York Times.
Oh, that's
amazing. And we got our 3 stars and I was just like, well, shit.
Yeah.
I was like, she would be so proud.
Do you talk to her?
Of course.
So her urn sits in our living room and talk to her a lot.
Yeah.
Funny enough, also my wife does, which I really love.
I love
think
that.
It's really
of
cute.
Course.
But that's sometimes amazing. Something good will happen and she'll be like, Emma, did you hear?
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah. And
that's
so
amazing.
I mean, my wife has been amazing. I laugh about it, but so I decided actually to propose to her right in the middle of the whole diagnosis and everything because she just showed up.
Yeah.
We were in our 20s and we were just dating and, you know, people don't really owe you anything. And she didn't owe me anything at that point. And when my mom was sick, if I was at work or whatever it was, I remember there was a day I called her and I was like, what are you doing? She's like, I'm just hanging out with Emma. She's like, I brought her some food and Tupperwares. And I just like lost it.
It's a litmus test.
And I just
for a
started,
partner.
It's a really good one.
Yeah.
I mean, people can definitely be there for the good times, but if we're talking about bad times, I don't know if it gets worse than this.
And your mom got to know her. That's beautiful.
Well,
she knew your mom.
It was funny because I think their relationship got better as like this diagnosis went on, because I think my mom became a little just sweeter, like as a person.
Softer.
She became softer.
Yeah.
You know, I came out to her when I was 19 as being a gay woman. And I just kind of remember like, she was not thrilled about it.
Mm.
And then somehow later she was just like, oh, that's not important at all.
Yeah.
And like, well, love Trina.
It breaks down, right? Like your own mortality comes into play, you know what I mean? You kind of hopefully at some point can think about the things that really matter, you know?
Yeah.
I have a question that we like to ask folks on the show, which is if you had a piece of advice to give yourself in the beginning of this process, having been through it now, and you could kind of like meet your earlier self and tell yourself something, what would it be?
That's a good question. I think ask for help. Mm. I think I took on too much and I think I was scared to tell people or embarrassed because asking for help's not really in my nature.
Yeah.
But I think that I wish I let more people in and I didn't isolate myself as much because I think that I would have been a better advocate and caretaker for my mom if I didn't feel so overwhelmed all the time in my solitude.
Good advice. It sounds like you felt like you had to soldier up. And if you soldiered up, then you couldn't ask for help. But again, duality. Maybe we can do both. That's wonderful advice to give people. Yeah.
This was an amazing talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. And just thank you so much for coming on because it requires such an intense amount of vulnerability. And, you know, the goal is in sharing these stories that like someone else who hears this, you know, even if they're not going through exactly the same thing, just remembering that it becomes very dark sometimes when you're in these kinds of experiences. And it doesn't have to even be an experience where someone's dying. I mean, like there's all times in life when you get your heart deeply broken and you feel alone. And I think that like hearing somebody be able to be like, hey, I was there. I went through this. I had a dark thought. I had a dark time. I like never thought I'd get up from the floor. It just, it's so important to other, helping other people. And it's just really kind of you and really generous, yes. really generous yes. of you. So thank you nice. So much for thank coming you. And talking to us.
Thank yeah. you so much.
Yeah.
You have a big, beautiful heart, and that's what helps us yeah. get through difficult it things.
Was so nice to meet you, and thank you also so much for the cookies. They're
I
delicious.
I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
Can we? Could you take us to Brighton Beach sometime?
Yes.
Anytime.
We'd love to do that.
Anytime.
We don't just want recommendations. We want to go with you.
Yeah, I would love to.
Okay, cool. Thanks, Jess. Hey, Bobby. I hope you guys enjoyed our interview with Jess Quinn, who is amazing. Jess. We really had a great time talking to her. She was wonderful.
We laughed. We cried. We
ate rainbow cookies.
Yes.
Which is what I wanted to talk about. So rainbow cookies are amongst my favorite cookie, and they're a divisive cookie. Some might even say a small cake. And some people don't like them. They have a lot of almond paste in them. It's like almond, raspberry, chocolate. And I think even just the colors can be triggering to people's sense of like, ooh, I don't like that. Or opposite, and people are like, oh, I love rainbow cookies. Where do you fall on the rainbow cookie spectrum?
Well, I had never eaten one. I had seen many, many, many. In
my I somehow don't believe you.
My husband's family, they bake every year for Christmas.
And you never tried one?
I was never attracted to the green and red until the other day we were in Cobble Hill and you took me to Caputo's, right?
Is Caputo's, yeah. Caputo's. They have a good one.
And I tasted it for the first time, and I love the almond paste. It was actually delicious.
Yeah, and when yeah. you had one when we were here, didn't you? Or did you have a different kind?
I don't like them.
You until do I
never,
like them.
I never had one until Caputo's.
Okay, so you didn't yes. have the one
no.
when Jess was here.
No.
Big mistake. Those might have even been better than the Caputo's. Mm. They were very delicious.
I will learn from my mistakes.
Yeah, please. Please come back next time with all your mistakes fixed, all right, Bobby? Another thing we chatted a lot about was Russian food in Brighton Beach. And after Jess came on and chatted with us, I took myself on a little unguided trip of Brighton Beach. I should have reached out to her, and I will probably next time. But I just kind of woke up one morning feeling really inspired to go, so there wasn't much planning involved. And I had a great time. I went to the Brighton Bazaar supermarket, which is the supermarket that's full of every kind of Russian food, sausages and salamis and... I guess they don't call it salami, but cured meats.
Right.
Lots of jarred things, pickled fishes and smoked fishes and cabbage. I'm going to name every food available in life. But it was really cool. And then I went and took myself out for a little lunch with some dumplings, of which I do not know how to pronounce the name, so I'm not going to butcher it, but tiny, almost like baby pierogies.
Mm-hmm.
What's your feeling about Russian food? I know you love it.
Well, I happen to love Russian food. My father was Russian.
Yeah.
And I remember him having borscht. There was always borscht in the
cold
house.
Cold or hot?
He didn't make it. He would buy it.
Okay.
I can't remember the brand. But
cold or hot?
Cold.
Okay.
Cold with a dollop of sour cream on
yeah,
top.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And stroganoff.
Mmm.
I always love Russian food.
Yeah, me yeah. too. I really love it too. So then I bought some of these little dumplings to bring home frozen from the restaurant because they sold them. And... my good friend Danny came over, and Danny and I made us some borscht, but I made hot borscht
right.
that had beef in it. And I put in red cabbage, beets, cherry tomatoes, what else? Some other wacky things. Oh, I put cilantro in it and dill because there's an area where China and Russia meet, mm-hmm. and you find a lot of this delicious Chinese food that has a little bit of like a Russian influence.
Yes.
And then even in that area in Brighton Beach, there's Korean Russian restaurants.
So
I was like, cilantro is a natural to put into this borscht. I put it in. It was like awesome.
Wow. Cool.
Tons of dill, red onions, basically anything red I could find. I think I put some like radishes in there, some red potatoes. It was really good. And then I made the dumplings on the side and I put just like butter and then a little sour cream on top. And then because I'm a part of an Italian and part Russian, I put pecorino cheese because every dumpling somewhere is kind of the same.
Right. That is true.
But I loved it. And I sat on the beach, it was kind of a nice winter day. It was maybe in like the 50s and I just sat and looked at the beach and just really wonderful to see all the different neighborhoods in New York that are so rich in their culture.
Yes.
So much so that their English is rarely even spoken, and I really love that. And we're really lucky to live in a city.
Yes.
We are lucky to live in a city of so many immigrants and so many different cultures and so many different people.
One of the things I loved about this podcast was the description of the memorial kind of dinner for her mom at a restaurant in Brighton Beach. Yeah. I love that description.
Yeah, with all the great vodka. And
fantastic.
Yeah, it was a great interview. I loved chatting with Jess.
Yeah.
She was a really, such a tender and sweet and vulnerable.
It was a tender
person.
Episode. It's the perfect way to describe it.
I really, really loved meeting her, and I really want to go to eat at her restaurant. It's fancy. Maybe we can go.
Oh, let's
Should we go
it.
Right now?
Okay.
Yeah? Take a loan out?
Got it.
Okay. thanks to Jess, and just a reminder for everyone to please rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast processing, because it helps. Mm-hmm. It helps us become more visible, and the more visible we are, the more people who can tune in and hopefully find some comfort and solace in knowing that, you know, there's a community of folks out there. And what is it, Bobby?
And send us your stories. And if you feel like you'd like to be a guest on the show, we'd love to have you.
Oh, yeah.
I think we've been getting more and more guests now of people who are listening to the podcast. And that's so exciting.
And listener letters.
Yes.
Write us a letter. We'd love to read it on air if that's okay with you. Or not read it on air. And just if you wanted to send us a note that you'd like to keep private, we're happy to keep it in the vault. Bobby, it was nice to hang out with you today.
You too, sweetie.
You're cute. I love you.
I love you too.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you so much for joining us for Processing. We realize that sharing these types of deeply intimate stories on air is a very personal decision. We began this project as a way to connect our listeners through shared experiences and storytelling. We hope that Processing can be a platform for sharing, learning, and healing. We appreciate our guests' willingness to be vulnerable and value nothing more than making both our guests' and listeners' experiences with our show positive and progressive. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or writing in a listener letter, please email processing@heritageradionetwork.org. Please follow us at processing_podcast on Instagram. Processing is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.